Chapter 43. Lady Killers. The three doctors called in to pronounce upon Henri Désiré Landru's mental condition were agreed upon one thing. The man, despite the 10 women he was said to have murdered, was not mad. The first medical expert, Dr. Vallon, faced the crowded court at the Lady Killers' trial and stated, "I already had to examine the accused in 1904, when he was being charged with obtaining money by false pretences. I found him then in a state bordering on the psychopathic, but he was not mad. Perhaps he was on the borderline, but not beyond it. I find now that Landru is perfectly lucid, perfectly conscious of what he's doing. He is quick and alert in his mind. He's easy and facile in repartee. In short, he must be considered responsible for the acts of which he is accused." The second doctor, Roch de Fursac, added, "There is no trace of obsession. In examining Landru's personality, we have found him to be normal in every way." While Dr. Rubinovich said, "We were struck by his subtlety and presence of mind. His psychology is what might be called that of the transportee. Transportation is always before his eyes as a nightmare which threatens him. The transportee has to live, and his past means that he cannot be choosy about the means he employs to keep himself alive. He will use any means to avoid being caught and sentenced afresh, to avoid transportation. Landru was in this position in 1914. Landru, whose criminal and sexual career had been under police surveillance for some 20 years, was jubilant when he heard this. "The crimes of which I'm accused could only be explained by the most pronounced insanity," he asserted. "The doctors say I'm sane, therefore I'm innocent." Said to be completely lacking in moral responsibility, Landru displayed an ambivalent attitude towards women, whom he courted like any other man, and later killed with a casual lack of feeling that characterizes the psychopath. If murderers derived their interest, like butterflies, from their rarity value, then Landru would belong to the rarest and strangest of species, the lady killer. A surprising statement, perhaps, if you consider that over 50% of all murder victims are women, but this is because the commonest type of murder is the family quarrel, in which the husband kills his wife in a fit of rage or jealousy. Much lower on the list, but still providing a high proportion of the crime figures, is the sex murder. The sex killer has the mentality of a hungry fox. Women are chickens who are protected from him by a screen of social conventions. Like a fox, he waits for his opportunity to slip under the wire and to help himself. Landru, however, was not a sex killer in this sense. On the contrary, he belongs to the very small group of killers who chose to make a poor living – Landru earned about £100 a victim – by the destruction of gullible women. He was possessed by a strange, morbid compulsion, the same compulsion we can see in the case of the French werewolf Martin Dumollard, of George Joseph Smith, the British Brides in the Bath murderer, of H. H. Holmes, the American mass killer, of the wife poisoner George Chapman, of the Hungarian bluebeard Bella Kiss, perhaps even in the case of Jack the Ripper himself. In order to understand the nature of this compulsion, the question must be asked, why are these lady killers called bluebeards? The original Bluebeard, the 15th-century Marshal of France, Gilles de Rais, who fought beside Joan of Arc, was not a killer of women, but of children. Noted because of his glossy blue-black beard, he was a sexual pervert, and also thought he could use the children's blood in the making of gold. But it was the French writer of fairy stories, Charles Perrault, who created the popular version of Bluebeard, the lady killer, in the late 17th century. One of his more macabre stories tells how a young girl, Fatima, marries the rich landowner, Bluebeard, and one day looks into a secret room to find there the bodies of his previous wives. Although Perrault wrote the tale from the Gallic viewpoint, many countries have similar legends of wife killers. Cornwall has a story of a giant called Bolster who killed his wives each year by throwing rocks at them. The folk imagination understands these dark male compulsions to destroy women, and also the woman's half-frightened, half-fascinated attitude towards it, which in some cases leads her to invite assault and violence upon herself. The strange thing is that all the known cases of real-life Bluebeards are fairly modern. Of the hundreds of criminal cases contained in such compilations as Lives of the Most Remarkable Criminals, 1735, the Newgate Calendar, 1774, and even Camden Pelham's Chronicles of Crime, published as late as 1886, there are no lady killers. Highwaymen, pirates, cutthroats, housebreakers galore, but no lady killers. So why should this be? If folk legend had been obsessed by Bluebeards for centuries, why up until then should there have been no real-life Bluebeards? The work of the psychologist Abraham Maslow suggests a fascinating explanation, which, if correct, throws an entirely new light on this question and on the history of crime. Maslow's basic theory, first published in 1942, is known as the hierarchy of needs or values. It was intended as a counterblast to Dr. Sigmund Freud's theory that man's basic needs are sexual, not to mention Karl Marx's theory that his basic needs are economic, and Alfred Adler's theory that basic human urge is the will to power. Maslow pointed out that if a man is starving, he has no other strong urge except the urge to eat, and he cannot imagine any higher bliss than having large and regular meals. But as soon as he achieves regular meals, he begins to brood on security, the need for a roof over his head. If he achieves this, he now begins to think about sex, not just rape, but a mate to settle down with. And when a man has got a home, a good job, and a happy family, what's the next thing he wants? Respect and admiration, to be accepted socially, to be liked, and if possible, envied by his neighbours. This is the stage at which men join rotary clubs and wives form coffee groups and worry about keeping up with the Joneses. At this stage, the urge for self-esteem becomes paramount, and this explains the penchant of some killers. Heath is a classic example for dressing up as heroes and officers. Once all these needs are satisfied, what then? According to Maslow, the highest level of all can emerge, the creative urge, what in more old-fashioned days we would have called his spiritual drives. But this is not restricted to the emotional and egotistical need to write symphonies, compose plays in blank verse, or build cathedrals. Anybody who wants to do a job well, just for the sheer pleasure of it, is expressing the creative urge. From this, it can be seen that Maslow's hierarchy of needs is a kind of ladder. If you're stuck on the bottom rung, then Marx's materialistic theories will strike you as true. If you're stuck on the next rung, it will be clear that the psychoanalyst Freud was right when he said that there is nothing more important than sex. On the next rung, the Austrian analyst Adler's will to power and self-esteem will seem the profoundest truth about human nature. All are partly right. None is wholly right. Maslow's theory is borne out by the history of crime. In primitive societies, food and territory are the most important things, and if a man commits a murder, it's likely to be for one of these two reasons or drives. Until 100 years ago, for instance, most people in Europe and America were living at mere subsistence level. These were the conditions under which Burke and Hare, the two Edinburgh body snatchers, committed their murders in 1828, and it's not surprising that they killed human beings for the sake of a few pounds paid by Dr. Knox of the medical school for the corpses. This is basically the reason why the Newgate calendar is so full of footpads and burglars and highwaymen, and why there are so few rapists. Society was still stuck on the bottom rung of Maslow's ladder. The Victorian age rolled on, and the tide of prosperity spread slowly across Europe. Most of the famous British Victorian murders were still for gain, but the age of middle-class murder had arrived, bringing in the domestic dramas of such killers as Constance Kent, who butchered her 4-year-old half-brother, mass poisoner William Palmer, wife poisoner Dr. Edward Pritchard, Madeline Smith, the Scottish girl who disposed of an unwanted and awkward lover. And then in 1888, the savage and apparently motiveless murders of 5 London East End prostitutes by the unknown killer nicknamed Jack the Ripper signalled the beginning of a new age, the age of sex crime. Society, by virtue of its progress and growth, had reached the next rung of Maslow's ladder. By the 1940s, sex crime, one of the rarest of all reasons for murder, had become commonplace. It still is. But already, the next age has begun. The age of what could be called the self-esteem murder. Why did the London gangster brothers Ronnie and Reggie Cray commit murders in front of a crowd of witnesses? The answer sounds astonishing. To impress the London underworld. The element of pride, of self-esteem, becomes increasingly common among murderers, whatever the motive appears to be. Multiple sex killer John Reginald Halliday Christie loved exerting his authority as a war reserve constable. Heath posed as Group Captain Rupert Brooke. Arthur Hossein, kidnapper of Mrs. Mackay, wife of the executive of the London Sun, set himself up as a gentleman farmer. Charles Manson saw himself as leader of a world revolution. Typical of this new trend in murder is the statement of 18-year-old Robert Smith, who made 5 women and 2 children lie on the floor of an Arizona beauty parlour and shot them all in the back of the head. "I wanted to get known, to get a name for myself." There's one major consolation in all this. If society can get past the stage of the self-esteem killer, the murder rate should drop steeply. The next rung up the ladder is the purely creative stage, and creativity and murder are usually incompatible. Whether that stage will ever be reached in our overcrowded world is a matter for speculation, but if Maslow's theory is correct, there is ground for hope. As for Landrieu, the prototype and most quoted example of the 20th century lady killer, a brief examination of his adult sexual career reveals that he is a typical self-esteem killer. His Paris childhood certainly provides no hint of his subsequent anti-women activities. He was a sunny, good-natured child, liked by everyone and adored by his parents, as his name, Désiré, hints. His father was an ordinary workman, a stoker. When Landrieu left school, he went to work in an architect's office, and his old friends immediately noticed the change. He became stuck up, and he lost no opportunity to mention that he was a white-collar office worker. He had achieved middle-class status, which in the French provincial society of the 1890s meant considerably more than it would today. For the rest of his life, Landrieu played this part of the member of the professional classes. He posed as a lawyer, doctor, engineer, businessman, accountant, anything that boosted his ego, masked his inadequacies, and made him feel talented and a gentleman. Unfortunately for Landrieu and his future victims, society had no special place for the intelligent but mercurial young man. In the army, where he did military service, his record was excellent. Then he returned to civilian life, married the cousin he had got pregnant, and faced the task of making a career for himself and providing security for his family. But the prospect of a lifetime in an office job bored him, and he was too unstable to stay in any one job for long. Attempts to launch his own businesses invariably failed. His natural charm and alertness suggested petty fraud and false pretences as a means of tiding his wife and 4 children over bleak periods, and it was with the enthusiasm of someone who has finally found his niche that he turned to crime, a more exciting, more creative way of living than office work. Experience showed him that elderly widows were particularly gullible and eager to give him the keys to their hearts and to their deposit boxes. Being a confidence trickster, especially such a well-loved and successful one, appealed to his vanity, to his intelligence, even to his artistic impulse. For, as Thomas Mann, the German Nobel Prize winner, pointed out in his novel Felix Krull, Confidence Man, the confidence trickster has a touch of the artist about him. Inevitably, there were periods in jail, and when in 1912, when Landrieu was 43, his father committed suicide, overwhelmed by his son's disgrace, the con man entered a new phase of his career. He determined to throw all scruples to the wind and to make an audacious career of murder. It's a curious fact that, with one borderline exception, the lifestyles of all the best-known lady killers resemble Landrieu's in certain basic respects. Johann Hoch, born in Strasbourg in 1860, was intended for the ministry, but left Germany for undisclosed reasons and went to the United States. There he advertised in German language papers for widows without children, object, matrimony. This technique was very like Landrieu's. He represented himself as a wealthy businessman or a man with a respectable position in a commercial company. He married the woman, if necessary, parted her from her money, and decamped. Unlike Landrieu, he appeared to prefer poison when it came to dispatching his brides. He was married some 13 times, unlucky number as far as the wives were concerned, and poisoned 6 of his brides. He was executed in Chicago in 1906. H.H. Holmes, perhaps the most remarkable American criminal of the 19th century, was also born in 1860, the son of a postmaster. Determined to rise in the world, he studied medicine and then became a swindler. His first known murder was of a store owner, a Mrs. Holden, in Chicago. Holmes duly became owner of the store. He then built a house, riddled with secret passages, and proceeded to murder women on a large and carefree scale. The motive was not sexual, for most of the girls had been his mistress for some time before they vanished. At least 8 women disappeared after entering his murder castle, and he later schemed with a man named Pitezel to swindle an insurance company. In the end, as often happened with Holmes's friends, Pitezel and three of his children were killed. Mrs. Pitezel was also on the murder list, but Holmes was arrested before he could eliminate her. In all, he confessed to 27 murders. He was hanged in 1896. George Chapman, actually a Pole called Klosowski, was executed in 1903, having been found guilty of poisoning three wives. Chapman's English was poor, and the early part of his life was spent abroad, so altogether less is known about him than about other notable lady killers. The son of a carpenter, he spent much of his life trying to better himself, setting up in various businesses, including those of barber and publican. He was in Whitechapel in London's East End at the time of the Ripper murders, and has been suspected of being the Ripper. There's no evidence that he was ever involved in swindling, and the motive for the poisonings has variously been put down to sexual lust, craving for security, and money and sadism. George Joseph Smith, the infamous Brides in the Bath murderer, was a Londoner born in 1872. He was in and out of reformatories and jails from the age of nine. After a two-year sentence for receiving stolen goods, he embarked on the career of a swindler of widows and unmarried females. He married and deserted an unspecified number of women before deciding to drown Bessie Munday in 1912. When his third wife drowned in her bath, a newspaper report aroused the suspicions of a relative of a previous victim. Protesting his innocence to the end, Smith was executed in 1915. Frederick Deeming, born in England in about 1853, was a confidence swindler who specialised in cheating jewellers by pretending to be the manager of a diamond mine. For reasons of gain, he also posed as a millionaire, and as Sir Wilfrid Lawson and as Lord Dunn. He was a braggart and a remarkably inventive liar. In 1891, he murdered his wife and four children and buried the bodies under the floor in a rented house. He then went to Australia with a new wife, who was soon murdered and buried under another floor. Posing as Baron Swanston, he had persuaded another girl, an heiress, to marry him when the discovery of his second wife's body led to his arrest. Three houses in which he had previously lived in South Africa also proved to have girls buried under the floors. He declared that the ghost of his dead mother urged him to murder women. Despite this defence, he was executed in 1892. Bella Kiss, an amateur astrologer and Hungary's most spectacular lady killer, claimed a total of at least 24 victims. When he joined the army in 1916, the new tenant of his house opened seven petrol drums and found them to contain bodies of women preserved in alcohol. Kiss proved to be well known in the red light district of Budapest, a man of immense physical strength and boundless sexual appetite. He had advertised for ladies to share his rural seclusion in St. Kotka. The ladies vanished, and their valuables provided Kiss with more funds for excursions to the city brothels. By the time his victims were discovered, the authorities had been notified of his death in action during the First World War. Later stories, however, told of him enlisting in the French Foreign Legion under the name of Hoffman, and of being spotted by a New York homicide squad detective emerging from a subway station in Times Square. One other thing that the lady killers, the men who mask their loathing of women with love, have in common is the so-called hypnotic power which they have wielded over their victims. This, again, can be explained by the way in which they carefully chose as their wives women who wanted, needed, to be subjected to the power of a superior man. These eager and willing victims, the murderees, cannot wait to meet with a man who's going to mistreat them, both physically and emotionally, and then to strip them of their pride, their dignity, their money, and their possessions. Without such women, who seem to draw their killers towards them, the Landrews and other Bluebeards would have no one to abuse, take advantage of, and fleece. Their hypnotism, George Joseph Smith was reputed to have eyes that could make a girl do anything, would go for nothing, simply because there would be no one on whom they could successfully practice. Every Landrew has to have a Madame Couchet, his first widow victim, and but for her and those like her, he would be no more than an eccentric possessed with strange ideas about the sexes and the roles played by men and women in the marriage game.